This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 256. We're recording on Thursday, April 12th. I'm Jeff O'Neill. I'm here with Rebecca Shinsky. We're coming to you from BookRiot.com. Rebecca, you had to travel last week, and you missed craziness, weird craziness.
I missed so much. I was in the airport, like casually kind of looking at Twitter, but I wasn't on our company Slack. I wasn't really paying attention to the internet. So I knew enough to know like things are happening, but I didn't know really what the things were. And I got to be honest, I haven't even completely caught
up. We'll catch up. We'll catch up today through the magic of follow-up. Jazz hands, sparkly rainbow. We will catch you
up with
you know, I was trying to do the More You Know rainbow from NBC. Mm. Doesn't really work in an audio only format. So luckily no one was Instagramming me or, you know, snap facing me while I was doing that. But sometime let me know and I will do that hand gesture for you in person and you can laugh hysterically.
I cannot wait.
At me. Michelle will certainly request it as soon as she hears the show that I perform that for her. Anyway, so what it was funny, I was talking to our mutual friend and Jeremy, who works on Ante with us, about both of these stories yesterday, the Nobel one and the Circe pricing one. And it occurred to me that it's both the smallest and the largest scale of the book publishing industry, because the Circe pricing is about the price of one title for like 4 hours, right?
Right. Could,
harder to be smaller than that, that's interesting to us all. And then on the very top of the heap, it's the Nobel Prize, which is literally the biggest prize in literature. That is an epic career history-making. And so we run the full spectrum here. And weirdly, I'm still kind of more interested in the Circe stuff, just because...
I am too.
Yeah. Why are you more interested in that too? We're going to talk about the Nobel, but I'd be curious to hear your take about this.
I actually think you undersold it a little bit. Like, it is just about the pricing of one book for 4 hours, but it looped into so many issues, from what I can see at least, issues and like major elements of the publishing world. Because it's not just like, oh, a book got priced wrong because of what we assume, I think pretty safely, was a data entry mistake. It's Amazon did a thing and indie booksellers got mad and then other people got mad at indie booksellers and who has principles and is it art or is it commerce and what matters about where you buy your books from? Like everyone, those, when I did pop up on Twitter on the day that it was happening, I was like, wow, there's a lot of yelling today. Like everyone is very shouty. And I was talking to a bookseller friend who was like, you know, the indies are mad for the wrong reasons. And then people are mad at the indies for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. And everyone is just mad today. And I think that was on Friday. And I was like, well, the great thing is that by Wednesday next week, no one will care anymore.
I think people do care. I think we're in the post-mortem stage though. Like we're trying to figure out, you know, looking at with someone like a cool and collected eye. So there's some more information I can report to. So a couple things. When Jenna recorded last week, it was a Monday. So the Circe was going to be released the next day. And we were trying to find out is, was anyone who pre-ordered at a price higher than $279 going to be charged more than $279 through Amazon? And we've had a lot of people report into us, and everyone that we've heard from that bought Circe as a pre-order got it at $279. Everyone did through Amazon.
Yep.
So there's that. That is hard data. It's limited data.
One big question answered,
One big question, at least on our side. For those of you keeping score at home, it looks like we tracked through our own Amazon affiliate link 358 hard copies pre-ordered through us of Circe. Now, what I don't know is how many of those happened before or on either side of the 279 window. I know a lot of them came in during that 279 window. It was like a three-hour window, which is kind of crazy. But that's where we stand. And the other thing I was saying to Jeremy is like, well, that's a lot for us to just have tracked. But also, people who heard about it through Book Riot, not all of those sales are going to show up through our affiliate link.
Right.
Because they heard about it, they saw the thing, and they typed it on their phone, they went to their desktop, or they went through somewhere else. And then some people bought it through Target, because Target had it at $279 as well, and it stayed up a little bit longer. And we put an update to our posts that were talking about this, saying, well, it's gone at Amazon, but still up through Target. And we know from some of our books writer insiders, some of our contributors, that we do know at least a handful of people went ahead and bought it through Target. So the total number of sales that we are responsible for, at fault for, guilty of, should get the, you know, I don't know how you want to do this.
Depends on who you were yelling at last
Depends
week.
On who you're yelling at. You know, I think it's not unreasonable that we're looking at, you know, 700 copies mm-hmm. or more that can be attributable to us, which brings in this weird point, which is if Circe shows up at like number 10 or 9 on the New York Times bestseller list next week, did we do that?
Maybe we probably contributed to it because we know you need what, about 5,000 in a week to
that. I mean, we can't talk about why we just were thinking so closely about this because that episode won't be actually.
It'll be coming out today when you're listening to
coming at
this.
The same time. The next annotated episode as we record this coming out on Monday is about how to hack the New York Times bestseller list. So we've been thinking overtly about all the things go into it. I guess what we'll be able to do is we'll be able to look at book scan numbers.
Right.
Right. And we can.
Are we finally going to get a book scan account, Jeff?
We need to talk about that. But I'm just saying, like, if in Publishers Weekly has the top 20 hardcover adult front list titles. So if it squeaks onto the list by a few hundred copies, I think we'll be able to say it was because of us.
Sure.
Weirdly,
let's take credit for it.
Or guilt. I don't know. Cause like, I'm not sure. Is this
guilt
legit?
Credit.
Guilt. Yes. The demon for this one is half white suit, half red suit, you know, on both of our shoulders. So the pot chicken's there. I've got one other piece of news, and this is a little birdie situation, so I can't attribute it directly, but someone in publishing
who
I was talking to this about, was saying they heard from a source that they believe 100% that this actually all started on Target's side.
That oh boy.
The price match was Target started there. Because we thought that maybe the mistake was on Little Brown or Amazon side, that Target price match, but actually the price matching can work the other way too, where someone at Target made a fat finger mistake, or you know, a typo mistake, mm-hmm. and then Amazon's price matching algorithm picked it up. And that's how we found out about it.
Right. Interesting.
So that's what I'm hearing. So that's there's my plot twist gif, you know, insert plot twist gif here of your choice. Which also can make sense. I think mm-hmm. we've heard through secondary sources, even since Jen and I recorded, that this was a mistake. I think I'm willing to bet a lot of money that this is just a mistake, that all the tinfoil hat stuff about marketing ploys, whatever. I think that's debunked at this point.
Yeah, the folks that I talked to said that they were also positive it was a data entry error, and that Amazon would not be willing to eat all of the margin on a basically $30 hardcover on one random title about mythology, just like for funsies.
Right. one publicized. Right. That was,
right. Yeah.
That's a smoking gun to me that it wasn't promotion, is that no one told anybody.
There wasn't like an Amazon email that was like, hey, guess what? You can get this for $279 today. Mm. And there wasn't anything coming out from Hachette, right? That nobody was pointing readers toward it is very telling about how it happened, and also probably how late in the game they were to notice that it was happening.
Yep.
And I think, you know, if it does squeak on to the bestsellers list, also the big question that I will have is not just how much do we take guilt credit for, but where would this title have ended up without these sales? Mm-hmm. Because Madeline Miller is relatively, I guess, well known in certain literary circles. The Song of Achilles did pretty well. I remember when it came out, we did know that people were really looking forward to Circe. But would it have been big enough to land on the list in its first week?
It's
probably not.
It's the kind of book we care about. Wouldn't you say it's like in the wheelhouse of midlist? Like
yeah,
this
that's
is a midlist
true.
Novel.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not a slam. Like
it's
a literary novel, you know, whatever. But it's not the kind of novel where it's going to be in airport bookstores on the front table. It's not genre.
In an
airport
tomorrow, I'll report back.
Yeah. I mean, unless it's really taking off. But like, it is. That's why I'm saying it's the kind of book a 400, 500, 600, 700 copies, mm-hmm. I think is not unreasonably to be a significant part of its pre-orders.
Yeah, I really wish that someone had a like noted the Amazon ranking of the book before this happened, and then looked at how many spots it jumped.
It went from number 128 to number 4 in 2 hours on Amazon. We were watching that. So there you
I'm
go.
So sad that I missed that day in the office where no one did
anything
except stare.
Yeah, it became kind of, it was like the March Madness of book things. Like we were like looking at it and everyone was talking about it.
Nate Silver is working on an editorial about it now.
But so anyway, next week I'll have the Publisher's Weekly data. I think by the time we record next week, we'll see if it makes any of the lists. If it doesn't make any lists, I guess that's kind of the end of the story. But if it does, we might can have some more.
Do we get absolved of any guilt, and we I guess don't get to take any credit if it doesn't show up on a list? That's
yeah,
fine.
I don't know. I don't know what I want to have happen now. Like part of me is just like I don't want any guilt credit. Just let it lie. But on the other hand, I really want to see what it,
I would like
it,
to know.
Matter.
I gotta say, like I wonder. I wish we could talk to Madeline Miller about this, because are you stoked that you just sold a bunch more copies of your book? Or if you get onto the New York Times list, is it a little bit like, oh man, but I didn't earn it because I didn't get there. Like I wouldn't have gotten there without this mistake. I wonder if it's, you know, I wonder if that's kind of like when you win a soccer match because your opponent's forfeit.
Yeah. They're the Roger Maris 61 with an asterisk kind of situation.
Right, right.
I would, if I were her, I'd take it. Like you know that like you had a weird circumstance, but people have weird circumstances all the time.
That's,
I mean,
true.
The person who had the book called Joyland when Stephen King's Joyland
right,
came
and
out,
people just mistakenly like, bought it. Right,
cash them checks. That's what I'm saying. Cash
that was
them
fun
checks.
To talk about too. I remember she had made a Tumblr of her Stephen yes. King money with all the things she bought with
yes,
it.
That's right. Madeline Miller can make a Tumblr of the $100 that we kicked into or whatever it is of there. So that's good. So if you've got any more information. Anything else to say, other ideas, I'm also here for tinfoil hat emails. I may not read them on the air, but if you do have them in you, I will look at them with glee.
Yeah, we'll take it.
You want to do our first sponsor,
yeah,
and then we'll talk about Nobel stuff.
Our first sponsor this week is If We Were Villains by M.L. Rio. This is from Flatiron Books. When a group of elite college thespians perform Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, life starts to imitate art when the lead actor ends up dead. If We Were Villains was named one of Bustle's best thriller novels of the year, and Mystery Scene says it's a well-written and gripping ode to the stage, a fascinating unorthodox tale on rivalry, friendship, and truth. This was also praised by Cynthia Dupree Sweeney, who wrote The Nest. It's been compared to works by Donna Tartt. And If We Were Villains is a love letter to Shakespeare. So if you are into Shakespeare, thespian stuff, and betrayal, this one's for you. Check out If We Were Villains by M.L. Rio, out now from Flatiron Books. You can find it wherever books are sold, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes.
Okay, so the Nobel, you also missed the Nobel, which was a little bit of a slower burn because it was coming out in Swedish and we don't know all that stuff. And I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions about
and
what's going on.
All
here.
I know about this is the Me Too stuff reached the Nobel Prize Committee for Literature specifically. Is that mm-hmm. right? Okay. And some people tried to recuse themselves from the committee, but you're appointed for life. And so you can't quit. Or something, and now the king is involved. Like, my grasp on this story is not
yeah.
so much.
You know what? Actually, now that you say, is it just the literature prize? I don't know.
So this piece we have from the Telegraph.
So the
scandal,
Academy's 18 members.
The scandal hit the committee that awards the Nobel Literature Prize.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so
okay.
It sounds like but it sounds like the bylaws that apply to them apply to all the committees.
Right.
So that's where I'm getting a little bit confused.
Okay, so you get appointed, and it's
to
for
catch
life.
You up here. So to catch everybody up. So there's an 18 member committee, and you're appointed for life.
Okay.
And a Me Too related controversy came to someone, connected to the committee, and
but not someone on the committee.
Not someone on the committee, but there was a suggestion there should be a police investigation.
Oh.
Some other things happened, and then basically four people resigned in protest because they think the Nobel didn't handle this right.
Mm.
That they didn't handle this, and I think they're on the good side of this. Like they're saying the Nobel should have done more to investigate, more to separate,
mm-hmm.
should have done more.
Okay.
And Jen and I were saying like this is a legit protest. Like the Nobel committee is. You know, maybe the most prestigious single like awardee slot you can have.
This is a
giving
seat
that
of
up
power.
Is not nothing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, but the consequences of this are these: that in the bylaws, there's a couple of relevant things you need to know. One is that you need 12 people to have a quorum so that you can actually pick a winner.
Okay.
So, okay, you lose six, you have 12 to have a quorum, you can still pick a winner in the bylaws. But the other thing, though, is there is no provision for replacing people who resign but don't die. So you can only be replaced if you die. So if seven people resign, mm-hmm. but they're not dead, the Nobel Committee doesn't have a quorum and they cannot award a prize, basically.
And then they can't award a prize until
people die, until they die and replace them. Essentially, the people who have resigned.
Oh, right?
there's your thing.
This is a failure of imagination on the part of whoever wrote these rules.
Well, and now let's go back to, because now we need to go back and look who wrote the rules. The rules were written in 1796.
Okay.
Right?
But presumably people quit things back then.
Well, I can't tell you exactly what people, what's the behavior of Swedish prize awardees in the late 18th century.
I'm afraid is
outside my realm of direct knowledge. But the current king of Sweden is getting to the mix.
Oh my goodness!
Because he is saying,
of course he is.
He is saying. This is a quote. It's not in the original Swedish. It is my conviction that the monarch has authority over the statutes of the Swedish Academy, which my predecessor, King Gustav III, established.
Okay.
So the current king, mm-hmm. Gustav XVI, is saying, well, since it was established by the king, that I can step in and fix this.
Cool.
But he hasn't stepped in yet.
So he's just going to.
He has said, here's a statement. In light of recent developments, I'm going to consider the need to supplement these statutes, including those concerning the right to exit.
So presumably it's like, if someone, first of all, they have to decide you are allowed to quit. And mm-hmm. that if you are allowed to quit, how does the Nobel Prize body go about appointing yes. new people?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two big things. So what is the, man, we need an expert here that we don't have, but I'm going to ask questions mm-hmm. out loud. What is the, like, these people who have resigned, they're not going to show up and vote just because a quorum can't be reached without them, right? Like, that's the whole point is...
That's the whole point.
Is we have resigned, now you guys are screwed, but basically the Nobel, like, the king is going to have to get going on something so that the Nobel Prize can continue to be a thing.
There's several unclear things in your you're picking up on multiple of them simultaneously. I think one thing is, can you resign? Like, is that you're not in the room for the, like, what is that actually? Does it have sort of force of existing that you've resigned, or
right.
you're just not?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like you're de facto abstaining.
Yeah.
Right. If you're de facto abstaining, right. does that count as a quorum? I don't, mm-hmm. who knows what the bylaws really mean about that. So, I mean, the other thing this dude did, the guy that's at stake here is named Arnault, A-R-N-A-U-L-T, who mm-hmm. both did some gross stuff, but also was accused of leaking the names of seven Nobel Prize winners.
And going he is back married to a woman who's on the committee, right?
That's the situation. The newspaper says the law firm believes he went on to leak the names of the winner in 2004, 2005, 2008, 2014, and 2015.
Okay, this
is a disaster. I mean, this is a disaster.
Okay, right. So this guy Arnault, his wife is on the committee, but he is the one who has been accused of all the gross things, and he's
yes.
leaking stuff.
Right.
And so one of the questions is whether she can resign because mm-hmm. her husband compromised all this stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. What a mess.
So it's a mess. Like, it's a mess.
Truly,
it's a real mess.
Like, no institution or industry is safe from these kinds of things.
Well, that's what Jen and I were saying. It's like, this is as high as it gets.
Right.
Right. You know, there's no mountaintop beyond this for which this to reach. I mean, it sounds like they should have changed the bylaws 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems ridiculous that you can't replace someone who's resigned, or you can't get rid of them for we're not even clear if the bylaws say you can get rid of someone because of gross negligence or fraud mm-hmm. or being a jerk.
If your husband gives away the secrets, yeah.
Yeah. So the king might have to step in, which, you know, I guess if you're ever going to use a king to fix a mess, I guess this is an okay one to do. I don't know. Emily,
and
one of our book writer insiders, Emily, who's a Swede, lives in a librarian in Sweden, posted some awesome pictures of Carl XVI at a public event wearing like Viking helmets and stuff.
Yes.
So, you know, it's really gone to a weird Alice in Wonderland beyond the looking glass kind of place.
So strange.
It's very strange. It's very strange. So
it's probably only going to get weirder.
It definitely is going to get weirder. We're going to move down I just added these things here that I'm afraid you may not know anything about. I think these are on our agenda. I want to talk about, speaking of you can't get any higher than this, we've talked about adaptation Gold Rush, and when's the peak? Well, we have a new peak. I don't know if it is the peak.
Holy crap, I just clicked that link.
Yes, there's two of these.
That's a B. That is a B.
That is a billion with a B.
What
so
even?
So Amazon is in the works on two of them. $1 billion literary adaptations.
This is unprecedented, right? It has to be. $1 billion for a literary adaptation?
Well, let's start with the one that's a little less surprising because we knew about it, which is the Lord of the Rings adaptation series, whatever they're going to do with the Lord of the Rings series. It came out that Amazon's financial commitment is $1 billion, and that's split between the rights to the Tolkien estate, you know, production, whatever else is going to be, but they're in for $1 billion.
All I can do is hear that in Dr. Evil's voice. Like, it is
$1 billion.
It's so crazy to think about $1 billion for a TV show.
I mean, if you reverse engineered the Game of Thrones stuff, it's probably $1 billion now.
How, you know, Amazon Prime works and how these TV series work. It just feels like impossible that this is.
Yeah, it feels impossible. Just for some context, like a big like Marvel Avengers movie, Star Wars, like the biggest Hollywood movie budget you're going to talk about, top out around, I think, $250 million dollars.
$1 billion. Okay, but so $1 billion for Lord of the Rings, I get you.
Wait, we're just one more minute on this because there's another interesting wrinkle here that came out about this news. I'm sorry I didn't put a link in for you there, Rebecca. Sorry, I'm hitting you with this blind. As part of the deal, they have, and I'm not exactly sure what this means, but they have the right to use stuff, references, characters, dialogue, flashbacks, or whatever from the Peter Jackson movies.
Interesting.
Which I find very, now they don't have to and they're not committing to it, but if you're paying $1 billion, you're just like, I'm taking all the rights to do whatever I want at that point. So like, I might not even use that, but I'm going to take the whole buffet. I'm taking all the peppermints out of the bowl after the meal, kind of thing. So that's something to watch out for there, that they reserve the right to use that stuff, which makes sense if you're spending you're ponying up a cool billion.
Just a billion. God only knows like what was on the cutting room floor from those Lord of the Rings movies too, that there's like...
Anything? Did they use it all? Because they're like a billion hours long. I mean...
Are you telling me that you didn't watch all of the extended footage on the Lord of the Rings DVDs when they came out?
I've watched them all.
Okay, good.
I've watched them all.
I'm pretty sure there's stuff on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, right. So I don't know. Like, I don't know what they're doing with this, but maybe they want to go get Viggo to play young, you know, play old Aragorn. Like, I have no idea what they want to do.
I mean,
they want Hugo Weaving to come in to be Elrond or something. I have no idea.
A million hours of Viggo. I mean, really doing whatever.
Yeah, but making moony eyes at elf ladies.
Perfect. show title. Moony eyes at elf ladies.
So there's that. And again, okay, big deal, huge headline.
But not super surprising.
It's not super surprising. Here's the one that's super surprising.
This is the one that just blew my hair back when I clicked this link.
Another $1 billion for the Hugo winning series of sci-fi fantasy novels by Chinese author. Lu Xixin. They're going to pay $1 billion for it.
For the three body problem. I mean,
for the three body problem.
The three bottom problem is like a completely different thing.
That's a different thing. You know, you got to get a whole new wardrobe, as it famously said in Seinfeld. This is shocking. You hear my like stunned vocal fry. I don't even know what to say about this.
My primary question is where is this going to air? Like, are we talking about just the US or is Amazon going to be able to air it internationally? Because this book is a really big deal in China and across the world. Like, I think, you know, actually the US came kind of late to this series because it had to be adapted into English. So if they can develop it and put it in front of a Chinese audience, who are already familiar with the work and probably clamoring for an adaptation of it, I would guess, based on its popularity, that makes a lot more sense to me than we're going to spend $1 billion on a book that like on an adaptation of a book that like the sci-fi fantasy book nerds of America know about, but that Well, but then again, like, there's just a ton of stuff that's doing well on Amazon and Netflix that is based on literary stuff that's just doing well on its own. And people probably don't even know that those things are, like, the bulk of the audience probably doesn't even know that those things were originally based on books. So maybe it's just going to be rad to watch. I don't know, but I have questions. $1 billion.
$1 billion.
Also, like, get paid. That's amazing.
Just a staggering amount of money. So a couple points of clarification. So The Three-Body Problem is the first novel in a series that's technically called The Remembrance of Earth's Past, but it's generally referred to as the title of the first novel in China. So that's the confusion. So if The Three-Body Problem is the name of a novel, but also some people call that, it's kind of like the Game of Thrones problem.
Right.
It's a Game of Thrones, but it's really a Song of Ice and Fire. But really, if no one's calling it that, what is it really? Now we're talking about dictionary war. use prescriptive versus descriptive. But so it's a series of books. That's, I guess that's another thing. So it isn't just one novel. It's a series of books called Remembrance of Earth's Past. But here's another question. And that, you know, speaking of things I don't know about, which is, I guess, what we're doing today. You know, so Swedish Academy, ebook, you know, book
an
pricing,
entire
Target,
hour of my brain making this
of just verbal flailing is... We've talked about adaptation gold rushes in relationship to sort of streaming and paid prestige television in the U.S. What is the Chinese prestige television market look like? I have no idea.
No idea.
Is Game of Thrones a big hit over there for HBO? I have zero idea. So it could be that it's speaking to a market that's... Maybe this is the Lord of the Rings move for China.
Right.
Where we don't know anything about it, but... It might make sense that China's a huge and growing market. It's everyone knows that. Maybe it's a good way for Amazon to get a foothold there.
Yeah,
you know, Chinese commerce stuff is really complicated, but it makes sense to me if it is.
I can draw that line a lot more easily than I can spend $1 billion to produce this just in the U.S.
Yeah,
and hope it catches on. Yeah.
So basically what we're hearing is we've got some sci-fi fantasy in the pipeline coming down in a serious way that is incredible. I'm super excited to see what both of them turn into. I haven't read The Three-Body Problem. I've really been wanting to, but it's super long and it's a series. And I'm not even sure if right now we're past O'Neill's Razor with it. I got a lot to learn about it. So anyway, this is definitely on the point there. I've got one other follow-up thing that's related. And now it seems like a footnote that it shouldn't be. But Apple reportedly is ponying up middle hundreds of millions of dollars to produce a series based on Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, which is another giant sci-fi fantasy intellectual property franchise. One of my beloved ones from as a kid. There's a billion books. It's Asimov, so people know it. But that's at this point, if you're not even throwing up $1 billion, we're not even going to talk about you on the show.
That's the new line. It was
the new table stakes is $1 billion for adaptation.
So these are the standards we have. It's $1 billion, and if you want something weird to get discovered way after death, it's like books, witch books that got saved by Nazi librarians or something.
And if there's a story that comes out that Amazon's spending $1 billion about a series about Nazi librarians, we have to close the show. We have to stop. That will be the end. There'll be nowhere to go from there.
First, we'll write a book that we bury in the forest for 100 years. You love that.
Leave that. You're going to spoil things that won't happen for like 2 years. You can't talk about that. Let's see. Whereas I'm all over the place now. Let's do another sponsor.
This is just all over. Well, so our next sponsor this week.
The next sponsor is Circe by Madeline Miller.
And this was booked like well before.
A long time ago.
These things happened.
It's funny because in all the talk about Circe, we haven't talked about what it's actually about. I mean, more than just like a thumbnail sketch. So let me tell you more about. So here we go. Synopsis. Sponsored by Little Brown. In the house of Helios, god of the sun and mightiest of the Titans, a daughter is born. But Circe is a strange child, not powerful like her father, nor viciously alluring like her mother. Turning to the world of mortals for companionship, she discovers that she does possess power, the power of witchcraft, which can transform rivals into monsters and menace the gods themselves. This is a daring, dazzling follow-up to the bestseller, The Song of Achilles. Novelist Madeline Miller has created an epic story of family rivalry, palace intrigue, love and loss, as well as a celebration of indomitable female strength in a man's world. I'm super excited to read this. We have a bunch of people that have now pre-ordered it for reasons that I don't know why, and are reading it and loving it. I'm hearing nothing but raves about it, and I'm so excited. I bought a full-priced version myself that I'm waiting to get in the mail. It's got a beautiful, shiny cover. Madam Miller's previous novel, Song of Achilles, which I also loved, won the Orange Prize for Fiction. It was a New York Times bestseller and has been translated into over 25 languages. While The Song of Achilles is a same-sex love story set against the backdrop of the Iliad, Circe features a powerful female protagonist set against the Odyssey backdrop. Just all my bells.
I was going to say,
if you hear chimes in the background, yeah.
This is all the Jeff things in one place.
I know. It's really, I don't even know if my face is like making bell noises at this point. And Patchett raved about Circe calling an epic spanning thousands of years. That's also a keep you up all night page turning. Man, that's a good blurb. So that is Circe by Madeline Miller.
Maybe you've heard of it.
Maybe you've heard of it. Thanks to them for sponsoring the show.
Oh, boy.
Where are we?
You
what
know,
day
we're
is
talking
it?
About weird stuff. So let's
yes!
just let's just
take
lean
it
in.
On. Let's go. Let's go.
Lean in and let's talk about Cassandra Clare. So Cassandra Clare. This is super weird. And like, okay, let me just tell you what happened. So
yeah,
Cassandra Clare, she's a well-known young adult author. She has a forthcoming ebook that she's co-written with Sarah Reese Brennan. It's called Son of the Dawn. And they are putting it out through Cassandra Clare's newly launched small publishing, self-publishing, whatever initiative, whatever you want to call it. So it's supposed to be released. It was supposed to be released on April 10th, but it was delisted on Amazon for 2 days last week because Amazon thought that it was not real. Amazon thought that someone was putting this up in an attempt to impersonate Cassandra Clare. Like someone at Amazon saw this on Amazon and was like, oh, this Cassandra Clare has a real publisher. This is a different thing. It must not be real. And they delisted it. So this is supposed to be the first in a series of 8 stories called Ghosts of the Shadow Market. Each one is going to be co-authored by Clare and someone from her writing circle. And it's an experiment in small publishing. So she is overseeing publication of digital editions. And then once they are released, the ebooks are going to be like once all 8 are done, the ebooks are going to be collected and released as a print anthology by Simon & Schuster. So this is legit because Cassandra Clare, her name is on the covers and it is her doing it. No one is impersonating her. And the bonkers thing is that the person at Amazon, like Amazon reached out to Cassandra Clare and she said, yeah, this is me. And Amazon like was like, basically in this piece from Publishers Weekly, Amazon says, well, we didn't think this is a thing she would do. So they pulled it anyway. It's very like I said to Jen on our Slack channel, like, well, you know what happens when you make assumptions. And I just don't know what to say about it other than this makes no sense.
I mean, on the one hand, I mean, the generous rating here is that Amazon is it's an interesting sign that Amazon is actively looking for fraudulent accounts, which we sometimes wonder about. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes the digital only world feels like the Wild West. And how much it is a Wild West is up for debate, and we don't really know. This is at least one data point. Again, it's only one data point that someone there is looking at stuff and saying, is this legit? Now, they made the wrong decision. I mean, they made the wrong decision. That there is no real mechanism for them to trust Cassandra Clare about this is also super weird, but also kind of understandable, right? Like, I guess what they should do, if you're trying to authenticate that Cassandra Clare is the Cassandra Clare of Cassandra Clare, what would you and I do, I guess?
Like call her on Skype video and see her face and say...
But how would you get her Skype video account?
Well, so she uploaded the text to Amazon for self-publication. Right. So presumably there's an email address attached to an account where she did that.
But how do you
so
know that's
her? So maybe you start
her
with email.
You see what I'm getting
you
at?
You email it. Right, but you email and you're like, hey, Cassandra Clare... Oh. We're following up on a thing. Can you do a video chat with us? And because she's
legit,
I
wouldn't even go that
yes.
far. You went a different way. I thought you were going to say the thing we do to just get to interviews and people with authors in general is we go to their publicist and we say, hey, we want to do an interview with you recommended. Can you give us Cassandra Clare's email address? Except in this case, we'd say we'd go to, I don't even know who her regular publisher is. It doesn't even say here.
Well, yeah, this is
we'd
go
to a regular publishing page and we'd go to the Simon Schuster's publicist and say, we've got a question for Cassandra Clare. Can you point us in the right direction?
Yeah.
And then you get an authenticated contact info.
Yeah. So Cassandra Clare inquires to Amazon about why the title is removed, and they email her back and say that they removed it because they did not believe that she would self-publish a book.
Right.
So I think they believed that they were corresponding with the actual Cassandra Clare when they answered this question from her about why it's gone.
Yeah, I guess it feels like they fell into a self-reinforcing doubt loop about whether or not this was legit.
And
they couldn't get out. They didn't think, or they didn't have the mechanism, or they didn't care enough to like jump out of it. Like,
because also take it to, like, you know, it feels like it has the flavor of sort of like a 5 years ago looking down the nose at self-publishing kind of thing. Like, we didn't think Cassandra Clare would self-publish. Like, lots of authors have tried interesting things on their own these days. And so that just also feels weird to me. Like, who is the we? Is this like one guy at Amazon whose job it is to look for potentially fraudulent stuff? Or did a like committee of people decide they didn't think it seemed like her? And why didn't they reach out to her about it before they took it down? Like,
well, that's
hey, Cassandra Clare,
yeah,
we think someone is impersonating you. Is it you or not? Like, I would want to be notified that they thought that like someone was impersonating me and have a chance to be like, yes, that's actually me doing a new thing. Or like, whoa, someone, there's a fake Rebecca Shinsky in the world. That it's all very, it's weird. I'm sorry.
Riddle me this, Batgirl. Have we seen a big time author with giant movie adaptations do a self-publishing experiment like this?
Didn't Stephen King do a thing?
Or was that within... That was print only through regular
bookstores. Bookstores only. Okay.
The point I'm getting at is that maybe we haven't seen something...
You're right,
Maybe we haven't seen someone do a self-published thing.
This big,
and
right,
that Amazon basically has filters on for the top 200 authors, and say, if we get a self-published request from one of these people, kill it, because their algorithm basically is right 99.9%
That's
of the
true.
Time.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like, I'm not
it
really
does.
Trying to justify it. I'm just trying to say, like, people do things because of reasons, even if those reasons are outmoded. And I could see a world in which, you know, because I even look at stuff, I see there's a deal for some book I'm doing for Book Riot Deals, and it turns out that it's like the summary version that they're trying to trick me into buying The Great Gatsby for 79 cents, but really it's like a summary of The Great Gatsby or whatever. There's all kinds of stuff. And Amazon, I'm guessing, doesn't have humans out there checking every one of these cases. Because what they found is they're all negative. There's no false positives out there. That's just my guess.
That this, like, the reply that Cassandra Clare gets from Amazon says they removed the title for distribution because they did not believe that she would self-publish a book. So, like, there was a person people at some point making that decision.
Sure.
Like, it sounds to me like it wasn't just caught by an algorithm. Somebody.
Well, no, you're right. You're right. I'm not saying it's computer, but I'm saying that the human algorithm was, if you see a self-published Stephen King novel, J.K. Rowling novel, you see what I'm getting at? Like,
oh, right,
just pull them
the
automatically.
Human algorithm, got it. Yeah, right.
It's not an algorithm, it's a heuristic. Yeah. Sorry, I'm confusing computer terms I don't understand.
Human algorithm is fine.
But I can see, like, we've never seen this happen before, so this is really an outlier. This is an anomaly that they're not equipped to handle.
Here's the thing I want to know is how many of these do they block, like, in a given month?
Yes.
That are fraudulent. Like, how many fake J.K. Rowling books are there that get uploaded to Amazon?
I've got to believe it's a huge problem. It's kind of like those stories you hear about Facebook, the people that have to watch like horrible videos on Facebook and YouTube and stuff to, you know, like really bad, really bad stuff, because you just can't have it out there. And a human at this point has to do it, because I guess for reasons of technology or whatever, AI can't really pick it all up. I feel like this is a weird situation. It's like a Bermuda Triangle situation, a bad one, not a good one like we talked about last week. This is a bad Bermuda Triangle where a couple of weird vectors came along that Amazon doesn't have the capacity to deal with a superstar author legitimately self-publishing something.
Yeah.
And even if they do and they get a flag saying this is wrong, they don't have a mechanism to go verify her identity.
Yeah, it's very weird.
It's very strange. It's very strange. But it is one. We talked about this, I think, at the very beginning of the show, not this episode, but the very beginning of the series of this podcast. Someday, someone is going to try to self-publish, like a major author that can move units on their own. And the thing that struck me about this is what that question I asked you about, name another one, is it hasn't been done before. Like, we don't have an example.
And Cassandra Clare even says here, she told her readers that authors should not be punished by Amazon for choosing to self-publish. And so there's a little, like, when we, you're right, we had wondered about that like 5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. Will Stephen King self-publish a book just to see how he does, right, without the backing of a publisher, just on the strength of his name alone? And it's interesting that one of the, you know, I guess unpredictable elements or things we couldn't foresee about that is if he did try, he might be hamstrung by an Amazon algorithm that thinks it's fraudulent mm-hmm. or that punishes, that like effectively punishes an author who is famous and has a big name for trying to go and do something on their own. But you would think it's not, I don't think it's like straight up punishment though, because if they're self-publishing on Amazon, especially if they decided to make it Amazon exclusive, you're doing okay there.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that, you know, there's kind of, I don't even know what you would call it, but there's like there's the return paradox when it comes to publishing, is that if you get to the point at which you're famous enough to self-publish and make money, you shouldn't self-publish to make money.
Right, right.
Right, because
right, you're self-publishing to like see what happens.
Yeah, there's not a marginal value that you're really trying to recoup, I don't think, at that point, because A, your time is better spent doing other things than doing the marketing and promotion and all this other stuff of your books. You're trying to basically maximize the return you get on the work you do, which big five publishers are great at doing with brand recognizable titles. Mm-hmm. Like that's what they're set up to
they're
do.
They're very good at that.
It's the, can you get a book deal, or you can get a book deal with no advance people that can see marginal value of self-publishing because it's a smaller number situation. You get a higher percentage. Whereas higher percentage, you just want to move more units. You want to move from 2 million units to 4 million units through a big five publisher. So I'll put a link in the show notes. You guys might be interested in reading more about why Claire is doing this, a little beyond the scope of this. She has co-authors and other things she's trying to do, but it's an experiment, which I admire. But, you know, one thing you do when you experiment is you find out if there's flaws in the experimental design. And what she found out was that this is a thing that could happen. I feel terrible for her and her crew of authors. It's super frustrating. And this is clearly a place where it falls down on Amazon's part. But it kind of makes sense to me that they fell down in the way they did, is what I'm trying to say. Does that make sense? I don't want to excuse them, but I kind of get it. I kind of get the mistake.
I get how the mistake happened. It is one of those things that when you do the postmortem on it, though, you're like, oh, right, there are maybe some process things that Amazon needs to correct about this. That even if the algorithm or what the human algorithm is, you know, 99% correct and is usually catching things that really are fraudulent and this was a false positive, mm-hmm. they're... can be layers of check kind of on those things to make sure that to correct for false positives. Cause it's not, this is not a victimless crime. People, you know, mm-hmm. she is harmed by this, and the ability to sell pre-orders and publish this thing and also conduct this experiment that she's trying to conduct was hampered by the book not being available on Amazon for 2 days. So Amazon, I think, could beef up its processes, it sounds like here, but I would really like to know if you are a little birdie and you have any information about how many of these fraudulent things are caught and prevented. We would be curious, and we will not tell anyone who you are. podcast@bookriot.com.
We should set up a dedicated little birdie at podcast.
We should.
Yeah, set up a dedicated. I think that's our show. We did. So we had a good time today.
It was, you know, I learned a lot of confusing things today, Jeff.
I learned a lot of confusing things. Welcome to the Book Riot Podcast, where we talk about what's cool. We should change our tagline to what's new, confusing, and impenetrable in the world of books and reading.
I'm just going to go work on my tinfoil hat until then.
Yes. Thank you so much to Circe by Madeline Miller for sponsoring the show today. Go check that out. Also, thank you to If We Were Villains by ML Rio. Go check that out as well. See, college thespians performing Julius Caesar. Are they trying to get at me? Are they advertising to me specifically? Like, I don't get it.
Episode is brought to you by Jeff O'Neill's Wheelhouse.
By Jeff's Bells. Jeff's Bells. You can email us at podcast@bookriot.com. Go check out Annotated if you're interested in bestseller related shenanigans. Episode 3 of season 2. Actually, you know what? I've just gone to straight episode titles. There's no seasons involved at this point. We're now at episode 9 of the whole series. Is out, and if it won't be out, it'll be out shortly after this comes out. Go check that out. We had a really good time with that one. Did lots of interviews. And what else do we want to say? The giveaway in the show notes.
Oh, yes. BookRiot.com/mysterygiveaway.
And we'll talk to you guys next week.
Have a good one.